Okay, so, so today the question is, how would democracy work in socialism? It's our FAQ session for today. Not long ago, I did a podcast for an American Republican website. I don't know if anybody, some people might have heard it. And one of the things that the guy asked me was exactly this question, how would democracy work in socialism? So, of course, I said all the right things, that this would be decided by people at the time. And it wasn't really for us at this point in time to speculate, etc., etc. But he wasn't very satisfied with this, and he pressed me for more of an answer. After all, he argued, we weren't going to win hearts and minds if we couldn't even answer a basic question like this. So, okay, so I hedged a bit and I said that, well, there were a number of different possibilities. And he said, such as, so I said, all right. So I offered the, as it were, default socialist model that has been trundled out numerous times in the past. This is the notion of the horizontal hierarchy consisting of local councils coordinated by regional and ultimately what you'd call supra-regional assemblies. Obviously, I avoided terms like country or national or anything or any words like that. Now, his response to this was that it sounded exactly like capitalist governments. So naturally, I tried to explain that, well, of course, it wouldn't be like capitalist governments because it would be genuinely democratic. But I did have the uncomfortable feeling that the structure I had described had already kind of lost the argument for me. In his head, it looked like what we have already. And in my head, I couldn't help but really agree with him. Once he had that picture in his head, I couldn't really shift it. It didn't really matter what I said to qualify it. Now, this, when you think about it, this default model of ours is really a very old model of representative democracy, a 19th century, or, well, actually, it's even older than that. A system made necessary, well, thousands of years ago, really, because direct democracy was impossible. It had to be done by some form of regional representation because there was no other way to do it. But this model has arguably been rendered obsolete by the communications revolution of the last 30 or so years. And it's our default model, only in the sense that we've never seriously looked at any alternatives. So today's question is it time to look for a new model of democracy for socialism? In particular, looking at how direct democracy might be made to work. Or are we still generally happy with our horizontal hierarchy? Do we still think it's fit for purpose, despite the impression it gave to my interviewer? So any contributions on that?
The party thinking about changing technologies, because I remember, probably 35 years ago, we were talking about the potential for using a button next to television to cast your vote, and for the television to be a medium by which decision making could take place, both in terms of voting and in terms of presenting the arguments. So it's not new, this idea among socialists that we've always got to, whatever approach we take, we've always got to couch it. We can't always give a bloody precise answer because we don't know what the systems available will be like once we've got to a socialist society. And that's not a get out, because if you look at the utopian constructions of the past, they become laughable quite quickly. So I don't think we need to apologize about, I appreciate your point about somebody keep pecking away at it, but I think we still have this argument, but we need to see what the technology is like.
Doesn't it depend on what sort of thing you're talking about? Because democracy covers everything, doesn't it? So that would, there aren't that many things you probably need to vote on a very large scale. A lot of decisions that are taken could well be done just locally, so wouldn't present such a problem for direct democracy.
I've always felt that even to have a fixed party position on this was a bit strange, because I mean, I agree with Anne, what Anne has just said. You know, it's like it's horses for courses. For different purposes, you would need different systems of gathering collective information and making decisions. But not only that, there may be geographical reasons why you might need different systems. And, you know, the assumption seems to be behind, you know, having a fixed view is that communism, socialism is a fixed kind of society. Once it's established, it's not going to change. Of course, it's going to change. People are going to experiment with all kinds of different means of organizing themselves. And so I understand that the party needs to have some sort of response to this sort of question, and therefore needs to have, you know, some kind of collective view on it. But I think it's really counterproductive to have some kind of idea, some kind of policy where people go out and say, this is what's going to happen and this is the way it's going to be, because of course you just don't know that. So I think that there are plenty of opportunities now for different forms of democratic decision making, from sort of like classical, even first past the post. But in emergencies, of course, like for example, you would need a very quick, very straightforward process, which may not be perfectly representative, but will give some kind of democratic justification. But another situations, you would need a much more thoughtful process whereby you can take into consideration the views of minorities and find ways to fight so that the majority of people get what they want one way or another, not just that the majority have their way and everyone else has to put up with it. So I think there are lots of different ways that this could be looked at, and I think that we should be keep that in mind and not sort of have a fixed idea about what sort of democratic view system is going to be in place.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it would be ridiculous to tie ourselves down to specifics in that way. At the same time, take Paddy's point, it's obviously not satisfactory just to say, well, you know, this is a problem that a socialist society itself has to sort out. So between those two things, there is one obvious source for giving people some ideas about democratic practice. And that's the practice of the party itself. And I think, you know, we have reason to feel proud of the way that the party has always operated. It's not a direct democracy. There are all kinds of activities that go on that don't have to be sanctioned by the entire membership. But there is that degree of control there where it's needed. So, you know, for most purposes, the EC can forge ahead and do things on behalf of the rest of the party. When push comes to shove, if the rest of the party doesn't like what the EC is doing, then it can call them to order. And so these are practices that I think it would be useful to call somebody's attention to if they're manifesting an interest in the party. And separately from any question of the exact technology that might be available, they give some idea of the principles that could govern democratic practice. And they also make it clear that the standard contrast between direct and representative democracy is overdrawn. There are a lot of possible and actual arrangements in between those two. And that's what I think is manifested in the way that the party actually runs itself.
I think it's also maybe worth pointing out that there isn't really any need for us to present a false dichotomy between having a fixed picture like a tablet in stone or a party line, and having no picture at all. Why can't we have a work in progress? So that if people ask us, we say, well, our best guess at the moment looks like this, on the available technology, on the available information. But of course, this may change as the technology changes, as the information changes. I don't see any reason why we can't present our picture as a moving target, or an almost, dare I say, dialectical process.
The trouble with muted microphones is you don't see people nodding in agreement. I hereby nod in agreement.
That's good to know.
Yeah, me too. I think that's a really sound way forward. And I think that this actually opens up the issue that we should be considering and thinking about the different ways in which we might organize. Not to say that this is how we will organize, but, you know, sort of looking at the different options, looking at their pros and cons and seeing where they might be valuable and where they might not. I think to have that in our backpacks would be useful, you know, when it comes to answering questions of this kind.
I think if I can just nod in agreement with Anne, I think we need to also be very, very clear about there will be certain areas that don't exist anymore for democratic decisions. You know, there won't be taxation and stuff like that. And you know, we'll go away from the government of people to the administration of things. And that's an important thing that we need to stress to anybody before we start talking about the type of structures that could possibly exist.
Well, Nod, yeah, certainly. And I think that since we're beginning to look at possibilities, I think we need to bring up the fact, or at least I think we need to bear in mind the fact, that conflict is not going to disappear in a socialist society. There are going to be conflicts of interest. They're not going to be tied to economic roles, but there will be conflicts. And I think, you know, we need to start thinking about ways in which conflicts will be resolved. I'm sorry to go back to sort of like hunter-gatherer stuff as well, but I actually find it really quite interesting to look at the way hunter-gatherers function, because they live in a property-free environment, and they have no concept of justice, for example. They laugh at the very idea, you know. They say, well, it's a ridiculous idea. Just your understanding of justice means that you're trying to put something right that's already gone wrong, and you just can't do that. What they aim for is social harmony, not justice. And it's a different sort of way of looking at things altogether. So just these are just like all kinds of issues that we could start looking at if we wanted to really tackle this issue seriously. Oh, and by the way, I think that party, the party system of governance is an interesting one, but I don't think we should promote it too much. Because it occurs to me that, you know, if we were faced with a crisis and we applied the party's method of organization, there would be bodies everywhere. I don't think it's perfect by any means. But anyway, sorry, I just have to let you know also, I'm going to have to go in a moment. I'm just looking in. So if I bow out, it's not because I'm bored.
I mean, I think socialism will have its own morality. Like, I mean, years ago, you know, before nation states and money and things, people were probably quite moral, really, you know, and I think that morality goes through things. It's not just the morality that you get in the Bible, which is probably homophobic, misogynist, and there's parts of the Bible, the Old Testament, saying the Jews should kill different tribes that aren't Jewish or whatever, and the monotheist religion and all that was responsible for a lot of horrors in the world and things. So, I mean, I think it will have its own morality, and how democracy sets itself up will be based on those kind of values as sort of natural morality. I mean, apes and things like that, it's been seen that they behave very morally. If somebody's week or something like that. The actual outcome, it might actually help them or whatever, you know. So, I mean, I think we've got to look at society from a cultural perspective. I mean, a lot of people believe their culture is the only culture that matters, you know. So that'll change, you know. You won't have Jews saying it's only Jewish people that matter. You won't have Christians saying we're the only moral people, you know. There'll be a new morality, and democracy will come from that, really, you know, I think. And I know socialists don't talk about morality, but I think that there is a case in point to say that people behave quite morally in certain circumstances.
There is an obvious danger in relying on technology to drive your democracy or to record your democracy, which is that it's easily subverted. And as we said, it's not that socialism is going to be conflict-free, particularly at the beginning of it. So setting up a socialist society that relies heavily on technology could be a bit of a problem. So it's important, I think, to have the structure there without it being heavily dependent on the technology, as indeed the SPGB structure is.
I mean, you could look at democracy in factories and things like that. I know that's probably not the model now, because there's not that many factories in this country that have thousands of workers or whatever. It's more of a service sector and things. But you could look at democracy in factories and how you can do things that way, you know, in socialism or whatever. I mean, I think there has to be some sort of imperative to look after everybody, which is what society should be doing when you know capitalism doesn't do that, you know. So you have to have a basis for that, you know, and say everybody's got a right to vote in different things, and take part in local democracy and even national democracy when the decision affects them, really, you know. And the internet could be used for a lot of voting purposes or whatever, on things. Not that everybody would want to vote on everything, really, you know.
That's actually quite an important question, I think, that Doug has just raised, is that, yeah, it's true, not everybody would want to vote on everything. And what do you do in a democracy where, well, let's assume that 60 to 70% of people don't want to vote on something. Or the other question is, how do you decide who gets to vote on things? This is something I got asked by this podcaster as well.
I think this comes back to what Richard was saying before. Well, maybe not. But you wouldn't want to be taking votes about... You won't want everybody to be taking votes about who becomes qualified as a brain surgeon or as a doctor, for example. You'd want to entrust that to specialists, wouldn't you? And this is where I think Doogie's argument comes in about the morality under socialism, and also that needn't necessarily be a negative thing, that specialists would have their own specialist democratic meetings, because there would be no, I mean, what I'm saying, but well things might get subverted in a technological world, which is quite possible, except what would be the point of subverting systems. Just to go back on this thing about the specialists, these people that are specialists wouldn't get anything material. There wouldn't get any material benefits from it. There would, of course, be social kudos, but that would be a more important thing in a socialist society. And I wouldn't see anything wrong with that. You know, I think the people that contribute most to society should be looked up to as good examples. Just one brief thought. It's a shame Richard's had to go, because I think he's got some extremely interesting views on the way that different pre-capitalist societies interact. You know, we've got an extremely narrow view of human beings if we stick to the capitalist system. And this is unfortunately what people always think. We are what we are because of what we are. Whereas if you referred to something like and although it's called into question, but Engels is writing about the Native American Indians who would appoint, for example, a particularly effective war chief, but they wouldn't have the power, the entire power within the tribe, and they could be deposed if they proved to have lost the competence. So there was nothing nothing fixed about these people's position within their society.
Well, just following on that point of Steve's, that we've got a very narrow view of how democracy is done, but actually it's changing quite a lot, isn't it, because of social media. What we've seen develop over the last few years is a kind of organic network of opinion forming. And now in this network, you see some people who represent very, very large nodes in the network with a lot of connections. And some people who've got very small, very few connections, corresponding to, you know, fairly outgoing people and people who are fairly insular. I'm not saying that's how it would be in socialism, but that's how it is now. And the people who are the very large nodes in the social media network are the kind of influencers. They're much more, influencers are a new phenomenon nowadays in the way that democracy is conducted in practice. I don't mean through the voting in, you know, assemblies and things like that, but the way that opinions are formed is much more organic now and widespread outside one's immediate community or social circle. And these people who are influencers aren't a bad thing, because although they reach far more people than your average more insular people, they also listen to more opinions as well, so they're processing more widespread opinions. And I always imagine that in socialism you'd have probably similar kind of processes, with some people being very well connected into socially, other people less so, and the whole process of opinion forming being organic in a similar way.
Yeah, I think you're right that there have been changes in recent years, and one aspect of that is an erosion in the percentage of people who vote. Now, I mean, I think this is important. It's important to know what the reasons are for that. Why what moves them to not vote? Because, I mean, that the whole system of representative democracy just involves so little input from the voters. It's a once in 5 years job. Then the people that you vote in are more or less free to do what they want, subject only to wanting to get re-elected. Now, if the theme of the FAQ sessions is what arguments are actually going to move people, I think that's a point at which that question needs to be pressed. There's been something of that erosion of the attachment to a very, very unparticipative representative democracy. How can we dislodge more of that, and in a positive way, which will bring people around to our way of thinking? That, I think, is one of the questions that's important to ask. And I'm afraid I don't have any good answer to it.
Well, I was a bit taken aback a few years ago. My elder son, who hadn't previously expressed any views on the socialist case, suddenly came out one day and said, it wouldn't really work because you'd all be spending all day, every day voting constantly in meetings, and nobody would get anything done, which is a kind of caricature we've heard over the years. I was a bit surprised that he somehow picked this up. But then actually, to be honest, when you look at the sort of internal structure that Anne was talking about, the internal structure of the Socialist Party, we do spend an inordinate amount of time going through these sort of fairly heavily bureaucratic procedures in order to arrive at decisions. And I just wonder if people looking on us and how the way we operate just assume that, well, that's how they expect socialism to operate, and that might give rise to that very kind of prejudice about being in meetings all day.
I mean, one of the things that socialism will have, there'll be a certain level of artificial intelligence, to do things. I mean, at the moment, I mean, I know when you talk about chess, I mean, Deep Blue beat, is it Gary Kasparov or whatever, they've developed a computer that can learn chess in 4 hours and beat the best chess engine in 28 games out of 100 and draw the rest or whatever. But artificial intelligence is going to take off. And in capitalism, that might be a bad thing because it might screw a lot of people's jobs up or whatever. But in socialism, with democracy, that could be a good thing for working out how to do things better ways or whatever, So I think but we'll have some advantage from the internet and some advantage from artificial intelligence that will be able to do things. You might even be able to tell your symptoms instead of going to the doctor. You might be able to tell a computer what the symptoms are, and they could maybe analyse what's wrong with you. Okay, they might need to test your blood or whatever, but they could probably have a good idea what's wrong with you better than a doctor, in many ways sometimes, yeah.
That's already partly the case, isn't it, Dougie? Because you can often find out about something that's troubling you medically just as well by looking on the internet as by going to see a doctor. The number of times I saw some figures on this, the number of times doctors misdiagnose are phenomenal. So probably just as much chance of getting the answer by looking it up yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the limitations of things like artificial intelligence is that they tend to work best with a finite and well-defined set of parameters, like you would get in chess or Go or one of these games. I think it doesn't deal so well in questions like how do you decide whether to cut down a forest to build a road or build the road round the forest, which obviously would cost more in resources. A question like that isn't just an economic question. It's about what people want their environment to look like. And I don't really see how you can get an answer like that out of a machine.
I don't quite know what was discussed before I came in just a short time ago. Sorry, I wasn't available earlier. But on this topic more generally, question of how would democracy work? I still do sort of quite a lot of work in the trade union I'm a member of. I'm a member of the local committee, etc. And amongst committee members, there's a sort of various views on how we should operate. I mean, I'm actually probably one of the least democratic in absolute terms because various people on the committee keep saying, right, this is important, we've got to have a meeting. And I say, no, we don't need a meeting. Most of our members probably won't be particularly interested in this and won't want to come to a meeting. We have the responsibility to take decisions. And as far as I'm concerned, this is one of them. If we get it wrong, okay, they can blame us and et cetera, et cetera. We can be recalled or whatever or not voted for. But nevertheless, it's been decided democratically that we're the ones make decisions on issues of most kinds, in fact. So, and I think in socialism as well, you'd have a situation where you give people responsibility for taking decisions, which they might sometimes get wrong. On the other hand, a larger group of people might get it wrong as well. it be the way sort of human society works.
Yeah, I can give a concrete example of that from the EC recently on the question of what to do about conference. The EC decided that without much difficulty that this was somewhat beyond their remit. A question like this shouldn't really be decided by four or five people, as it was at the time. And so that's why the EC called a general meeting at which 30 people came, and the decision was made that way. So certainly, yeah, judgment can be used.
If no one else is saying anything at the moment, can I mention something which is sort of connected anyway with this project? And that is that this week, BBC Radio is running a project called Rethink. I don't know if anybody knows about it. It's a series of programmes, interviews, what they call essays by various people on what they like happen after the virus period is over, how they like the world to work. And there's been a few programmes already which actually have been surprisingly uninteresting. They've been very, very much concerned with the nuts and bolts of capitalism rather than real rethinks. Anyway, the point is that listeners are invited to write in what they think, how they think the world should work after the virus crisis. There's going to be a program, I understand, of responses from readers. I've written one, and I know a couple of other party members who have. So if other people are interested, very simple. You simply need to send an email to rethink@bbc.co.uk. Whether we get any mileage out of it, whether any of our messages will be read out, is anyone's guess. But worth having a try. There was a programme earlier on today on Radio 4, in which they had one of these little essays, only about 5 minutes long, by somebody who you may know, and I don't think on the whole the party would agree with, called Steven Pinker, American academic. What he had to say was actually quite good. And he, in the course of the 5 minutes, despite what I thought were his previous views, sort of exploded the human nature myth. I mean, these things are worth listening to and, if possible, worth contributing to. And, the question of how you could have a wholly democratic society of the kind we advocate, might be something that could be brought into a contribution that party members might make.
I just have a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, yeah.
So it's just a broad question, but it is in the same topic. So the general principles of democracy mean that everybody's voice is counted, is considered, is important, and it contributes to making the decision. So my question is, why is it important to have everybody's opinion on a particular aspect of the subject, as opposed to having everybody's interest in mind? Do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure that I do, actually, Leon. Do you want to just expand on that?
Yes, it's a really sort of high-level theoretical existential, not existential, question. I'm thinking whether asking people on, for example, whether they want the road to go around the forest or through the forest is the right thing to do, rather than, let's say, what we really need is to take into consideration every person's need to have good environment, which is not even questioned. Everybody sort of understands that, yes, this is true. And then let the AI, already mentioned, just count what the best way to achieve this would be.
Okay, I think I see what you're saying, Leon. But you've still got to make a decision what to tell the AI. You've got to decide what the input's going to be so that it can then make the decision. It's not necessarily obvious that people would always choose the forest over the road. It would just depend. And the people locally would have to make a decision.
Yeah. That's the thing, that again, we are coming back to that question of whether people choose the road or the forest. But what I'm saying is maybe it's better not to give people this choice, but rather ask them a more general thing. Do they want a clean environment or not? So maybe in some particular case, it would actually lead to a better environment and cleaner air to make this particular road go through the forest and not around it. And people may not realize that because they cannot calculate as well as the AI. So what we really need to decide, is these basic questions of what is good for people. And I think most people will find it a lot easier to agree on these things.
Personally, I suspect that people would object to that. Having a machine decide what's good for you doesn't sound like the sort of democracy that people can relate to. It sounds like a technocracy. It sounds like the kind of thing that Zeitgeist used to talk about, where the machines make all the decisions. I actually think that the process of decision making is quite a pleasurable and empowering thing to be involved in. And I like work, in fact. And I think that I can't imagine a society where people would want to hand over decision making in that way, in general terms, to a machine. And also the problem with artificial intelligence, which they're now encountering, is the fact that it's a sort of black box process. You can put in, you can put your input into it, and you get an output out of it, but you've no idea what's happened in between. And so you can't interrogate the AI. You've got no way of knowing how it's arrived at its conclusion. And this is a bit of a problem for AI researchers at the moment, because they can't verify what the AI is telling them.
Well, this sounds more like a technical problem rather than a fundamental problem. I think it will be overcome. It can also be tested whether the solution given by a machine was the correct one or not. And so it can be verified in the end, maybe not explain how solution has come to, but verified. So there are various ways around this, but the sort of fundamental question that you asked in the beginning, whether people would accept and want this kind of society, well, this is what we have. We have what people are deciding at the moment, what they want. And we see that they want to shop, they want to destroy the planet. This is the result of their everyday desires and wants.
Anybody else want to come back on this?
The AI system that people are describing is obviously some distance away from existing parliamentary democracy. But what the two things have in common is that people are forfeiting a large degree of power to something or someone else. And, you know, I was saying earlier that there's been an erosion of the commitment to the parliamentary system. Nevertheless, a majority of people support it, a majority of people vote, and therefore pass over to the half-wits and chancers that form the government, pass over to them the discretion how things are going to be in the world for quite a significant period of time. And I think the problem for us, I'm perhaps repeating what I said earlier, is how we encourage people not to be satisfied with that system and to wrest back to themselves more of the collective power that they ought to have.
I can't really see how this answers the question, because what most people want and what most people decide are two different things. While we all want clean air, we decide to use petrol cars because they're cheaper and to pollute the air. This is the fundamental problem, that as individuals, we might be able to do, think, decide good things, but as a society, we function as one huge colony of bacteria that is consuming and ultimately moving towards its own destruction. Which is why what I'm saying is a system that is based on sort of fundamental principles where the technology as a code built around the general principles that we all agree on, such as equity, fairness, clean environment, sustainability, and so on, would not decide, but sort of maintain these things throughout the decision-making process. And then, of course, we can enjoy making small decisions like color to paint our own houses. And that can be very enjoyable.
Sounds good to me.
Howard, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
All I said was, sounds good to me. If you heard that. Did you hear that, Paddy?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
I was just thinking, though, that you could have a situation that Leon describes where you've got a gigantic, you know, algorithm that does it all for you based on you know, generalized socialist principles. But I think you've still got to be able to, at the end of the day, you've still got to be able to interrogate that process, because you could say, all right, the AI is going to decide whether to do such and such a thing. Well, build this road through this forest. And so the AI decides, yes, that's my considered opinion, that's what you should do, and let's get on and do it. Then you've got a process where people can say, well, hold on a minute, we don't actually agree with this. So then you've got to still have the debate after the AI has decided, because obviously people aren't going to just accept what the machine says. They're going to, if people object, then they've got to have the debate. So then the question becomes, why did the AI decide this? What was the thinking? And this is coming back to my previous point, which is that you can't interrogate artificial intelligence. It actually explain how it arrived at these things. So you still got to have the debate even after the decision has been made by a machine.
No, I was just going to say that, Paddy, I think you're right at the moment, but I mean, we're talking about the fairly distant future here. And I would see no reason why you can't build an AI which you could interrogate and how it comes to its decisions.
Well, if I could come in, just slightly different to discuss Leon's point. What you're talking about now is, or what you referred to, is a lot of people that living in capitalism, that you said, yeah, we all want cleaner air, but we all want our cars. Well, in actual fact, there's a lot of people don't want cars. They do want decent public transport because as an established fact. We maybe want to fly off to Spain. I mean, in England, it's Spain or Greece or something like that for our holidays. In America, you're American, aren't you, Leon? Isn't so? So maybe you want to fly to Florida.
Sorry, I just sound like
Oh, you're not? Oh, sorry. Oh, right. right, okay. But why do people want to do that? It's because they're being taught to want it. You go to these seaside resorts, and what is there to do? There's nothing to do except sit on a beach and get bloody sand in your picnics. It's just a nonsense behaviour is very, very much dependent on the way that we've been brought up in capitalism. I'm expecting that people aren't going to want all these so-called consumer durables in a socialist society, because basically they are to cater for this atomized society that capitalism requires, not socialist society, where things will take place in a much more social manner. In all sorts of fields.
If I can just tell like a story from how I came to this conclusion. Partly, I work in an organization in the Congo, quasi NGO. I don't know if you know. It's kind of a governmental organization, but it doesn't belong to the government. So we get funded by the government, the UK government, but we are independent of it. So we make decisions independently. And I listen to a lot of meetings, scientists, policymakers not in the government, a lot of smart people, mainly in environment, sustainability, this kind of areas. And I see that the discussion and the decisions and the proposed solutions are really based on the principles that also we agree with in the Socialist Party. And as it goes higher and higher and higher to these levels of decision making and finally gets to the government, this is when something happens. So, for example, our chief executive is on the SAGE committee, the COVID-19. And he says, well, yes, we are scientists and we are proposing what to do. But at the end of the day, it's the government who decide. So we leave the room, they get together, and they say they take into consideration what we say, but we don't actually take part in decision-making at all. We just propose, we advise. So this is, to me, where the broken link is. I can see that sort of the below level of your bureaucracy is working quite well, actually. It's higher up between this and the government is where there's no communication or there's some principles that are standing in the way. For example, capitalist principles, money, and so forth. So if there was some kind of not really technological as software, but some kind of an extension of the laws of the constitution, let's say, some principles that would not allow the politicians to not follow the rational advice of the scientists, that would really make a huge difference, in my opinion.
Oh, I don't doubt you're right, Leon, but I can't imagine any capitalist politician agreeing to bring such a system in.
Can I just say, sorry, just into the subject a little bit. I mean, I find what Leon was extremely interesting, I must say. To change it, just to come back to what you were asking, Steve, can I put up the statement I've sent to the BBC? Yes, I can. I've actually put it on the speaking queue now. A couple of hundred word statement, that's the kind of thing that's needed, I think. If other people can do the same thing, all well and good.
Well, now might be a good moment to wrap it up, as Howard's just put that on the speaking queue. So if anybody wants to carry on talking about that, we can. So we'll just call this part of the discussion to a close.